Are you listening? The apocryphal story goes that there was a man who died, and because of his great faith in God, he was admitted into heaven. After what appeared to the man to be a considerable amount of time, the man became somewhat unsettled by his experience in heaven. Don't get me wrong, the man really loved being there, but he began to wonder about how the other half were faring in, you know, the other place. So summoning up his courage, he approached St. Peter and made a very unusual request. "Excuse me, St. Peter," he said, "I'm wondering if I might have a look at what it's like in the other place." "The other place? You don't mean down there?" "Well, actually, that is exactly what I'm asking," the man said. "Oh, this is very unusual. No one's ever voluntarily asked to go and see you know where. I'm going to have to check on this for you, and I'll get back to you." So Peter and this man, they parted company. And it wasn't long until Peter sought the man out and said the following to him: "It was difficult to arrange, but you can have your look. Here's how it's going to work. You will descend in that golden elevator over there, and when you arrive, the doors will open. Now, this is very important. Whatever you do, don't get off the elevator. If you do, the doors will close, and you will be trapped for eternity." "I understand," said the man. And with that, he walked into the elevator and began to descend to the unholy depths of, well, you know where. After a while, the man returned to the safety of heaven, and Peter was there to greet him. "Well, what'd you think?" Peter asked. "Well, it wasn't at all what I expected," he said. "I was always told it was a place of fire and brimstone and incredible heat. But when the doors opened, the place was frozen over with ice and snow. Everybody was shivering." "Oh, dear," Peter said. "That could only mean one thing. The Leafs finally won the cup." We like to make fun of things that scare us. And I'm not talking about the Leafs' inability to win Lord Stanley's Cup. Perhaps humor lessens the emotional pain that would well up in us if we dwelt on things that make us squirm. This is no less so when we talk about the other place, or Hades, or as we tend to call it, hell. And hell is a subject we'd just rather not talk about at all, unless, of course, we can think of funny images of red devils holding pitchforks, and we make fun of it through jokes. Today's gospel lesson is anything but funny. In fact, at face value, it's quite a terrifying story. This particular parable is perhaps the most unusual one Jesus ever shared with his audience. For the first and only time in the Gospels, Jesus actually names a character in the story, Lazarus. Not the same Lazarus who was Mary and Martha's brother and who Jesus will eventually raise from the dead in John chapter 11. Some commentators have gone so far as to even suggest that because Jesus uses a name here, that perhaps it's a true story. Well, personally, I think that's just going too far. It's a parable. The images, the setting, the interchange between the characters are designed to shake us up, to recall us to what is essential, the essential truth of our existence. That it's not enough to claim that you are a child of Abraham. You must live like one. A child of Abraham. Now that phrase might confuse you. Perhaps it's not what you expected me to say. So let me unpack it for you. Remember that this story falls at the end of a chapter that Jesus has been teaching and debating with the Pharisees at length. Those same Pharisees we learned last week who loved their money, and those are the same Pharisees who believed that they were special in the eyes of God, that they were the sons of Abraham. And the phrase sons of Abraham was very significant. The religious elite in Jesus' day took an arrogant pride in their Jewish heritage because in their own eyes they were pious people. And they honored God by their behavior and their ideas. Remember what happens in Luke chapter 19? Jesus encounters a man by the name of Zacchaeus, a story we're all very familiar with. He goes and has dinner at Zacchaeus' home, and Zacchaeus is a chief tax collector. Not just a tax collector, he's the boss of tax collectors. The Pharisees won't even enter the house. They stand outside looking in the windows, grumbling, and make their accusations that Jesus cannot be a true prophet because he's fraternizing with sinners. In response, Jesus says of Zacchaeus this powerful phrase, "Salvation has come to this house because this man has shown himself to be the son of Abraham." Wow. Such a declaration. Giving a notorious sinner like Zacchaeus the same status that the Pharisees claimed for themselves. This caused quite a stir. It just fueled the anger the Pharisees felt for Jesus. An anger that had been building for some time and was started by parables like this one that we just read. In today's story, there is a certain rich man who enjoyed the very best of life, and yet he lived under a false impression. He too believed that he was a true child of Abraham, and I suspect that he probably believed that because he was so wealthy, God was blessing him. I suspect he just thought the sun was shining just on him. And while he was enjoying his choice food and his wonderful wine, there was a beggar who Jesus refers to as Lazarus, was lying at his door. The poor man's existence was literally hell on earth. He was starving. He was relying on whatever scraps he could gain from the rich man's table. He was also very sick, and he was in such physical misery that he didn't even have the strength to fend off dogs that came and licked the sores on his body. What awful that is. And Jesus is clearly letting his hearers know that Lazarus was not a hidden victim. He wasn't hiding under a bush somewhere. He was literally on the front steps of the man's home. You couldn't enter or leave this mansion without practically tripping over Lazarus. Despite his obvious need, though, Lazarus was ignored. Even when his very life was threatened by disease and starvation, he was ignored. The contrast between poverty and extravagant wealth are very clear to see in this parable. It was the obvious intention of Jesus. We read on the parable that both men end up dying very close to each other in time. The point of the parable is dramatically demonstrated that after their deaths, their roles become reversed. Lazarus, who lived a hellish existence on earth, is whisked away into heaven to the very bosom or the embrace of Abraham, the father of the Jewish faith. The rich man is whisked away to the place of the dead. In Greek, it's called Hades, or as we call it, hell. We learned that he lived in torment. Now, Jesus' audience hearing this would have been shocked by this turn of events. I'm sure they would have assumed that because this wealthy man had such a rich life that he did everything right in the eyes of God. And Lazarus, on the other hand, he must have really offended God by the way he was living to end up like this. This is the same argument we read about in the book of Job, believe it or not, which God dismisses as rubbish. The switching of fortunes in the afterlife is in Jesus' heart a matter of justice. In fact, Abraham makes this critical point in the story in verse 25. "Son, remember that during your lifetime, you had everything you wanted, and Lazarus had nothing. So now here he is here being comforted, and you are in anguish. Notice the word son that he uses for the both men. And of course, that means son of Abraham. The horror of the story is revealed in the rich man's existence in the place of the dead. An existence that's so bad, he longs for just a drop of cool water to cool the very tip of his tongue. Awful. However, even this simple act of mercy is impossible because there's a great chasm that separates the place of the dead or hell from heaven. There is no relief for this rich man. No comfort now in hell, as there was no relief or no comfort for Lazarus as he languished on the front steps of the rich man's home. All that man's wealth, power, and influence are now worthless. The rich man stored up treasures on earth, but he had no treasure in heaven. Out of a sense of urgency, the tormented man, now in the place of the dead, or it's literally called Hades, begs Abraham, please send Lazarus to my father's home to warn my five brothers. But Abraham dismisses the request by stating that the five remaining brothers have Moses and the prophets to warn them, and they can read their writings whenever they wish. Then he begs Abraham to send someone back from the dead to warn them. Abraham replies, if they won't listen to Moses and the prophets, they won't listen even if someone comes back from the dead. Jesus' point is clear here. Those who listened to him that day, like the Pharisees, had all the writings of the prophets to warn them that their declared faith required them to address the hellish existence of people on earth. That was the demand of the law. It is the highest level of hypocrisy, Jesus is trying to say, to claim that you have an allegiance to God and behave like you've never heard one single word about how he wants us to live in this world. The same point is made again in Matthew 25 in the parable of the sheep and the goats. The sheep go to paradise because they cared for those who were hungry and thirsty and naked and lonely in prison, etc. And the goats go to Hades to live in torment because they haven't cared for the least of these, the least of Jesus' brothers and sisters. Jesus is saying that God has made it abundantly clear in his word that his true children live out the covenant that God made with Abraham. Live it out by relieving the hell that people are living in right now on this earth. Matthew 7, beginning at verse 21. Not all people who sound religious are really godly. They may refer to me as Lord, but they won't enter the kingdom of heaven. The decisive issue is whether they obey my Father in heaven. On judgment day, many will tell me, Lord, Lord, we prophesied your name and cast out demons in your name. We performed many miracles in your name. But I will reply, I never knew you. Go away. The things you did were unauthorized. The point is, if we really were children of Abraham, followers of Christ, or children of God, then people who are living like Lazarus could count on us to ease their situation. The Word of God has given us ample warning. And even when Jesus rose from the dead and came back to warn us, many would not listen. So I go back to my original observation that we often use humor to mask our fear, to lessen the painful reality of our existence. Hades, or hell, place of the dead, are realities that we cannot easily dismiss with humor. Nor can we dismiss that our faith, as it is lived out, reveals the true level of our relationship with God. As with last week's message, today's parable speaks loudly to the fact that we are going to be held accounted for. We're going to be asked where our true riches are and how we invested ourselves with ourselves and our wealth. Maybe you've heard this story before, but in one of the great demonstrations in irony that I have ever come across comes from a research study that Darley and Batson did at Princeton University in 1973. Darley and Batson took a group of theology students. Those are men and women who are going to be future missionaries or future ministers or biblical scholars. And they told them that they had to go across campus to deliver a sermon on the parable of the Good Samaritan for a good grade in their class. As part of their research, some of the students were told that they were late and they needed to make haste to get to their appointment on time or they might fail the course. Along the route the students would take to make their appointment, Darley and Batson had hired an actor to play the role of a victim who was coughing and in obvious pain. The actor was clearly noticeable and was in the direct path of the students. Study found that 90% of the students who thought they were late for their Princeton Theological Seminary test, of all things, completely ignored the suffering person in their haste to make it across the campus. As the study reports, ironically, indeed on several occasions, the seminary student going to give a talk on the parable of the Good Samaritan literally had to step over the victim as he hurried away. This little research study coincides with what Jesus is trying to tell us. Even if you think you're doing your religious service, like studying the Bible and tithing and praying and making your sacrifices, that never excuses you from caring for the people who are living a hellish existence on your doorstep. And the Bible's full of references that make that point, Old and New Testament. John wrote, "But if one of you has enough money to live well and sees his brother or sister in need and refuses to help, how can God's love be in that person? How indeed? I've come to understand fully that God hates hypocrisy. He hates it. And this whole section in the Gospel of Luke is full of parables designed to challenge, among other things, hypocrisy. Saying we are children of God when our lives reveal other allegiances is hypocrisy. The consequences of a life lived like this are truly frightening. And no amount of humor can diminish how frightening it is. There is a place of the dead. Hades, or if we want to use the word hell. Whether or not we end up in that terrible place is really a matter of how sincere and life-altering our faith truly is. If we continue to step over or around those like Lazarus, and come judgment day, Christ will look at us and say he never knew us. He will say we were strangers to him, because we have not sought to be like him. And surely it will be the ultimate in bad days to have Jesus look at us and not recognize us as one of his own. And it's not like we don't know this. We have the scriptures. We have the words of the prophets, the words of Jesus and the disciples, Paul's letters and all of it to show us the way. And unlike in the parable, we did have someone come back from the dead to call us to a different approach to life. Jesus is our resurrected Lord, but we gotta listen to him. And have we sought by his strength and wisdom to live out his teaching in our homes, in our neighborhoods, our places of work, and even in this church? I sure hope we have. because the alternative is nothing to laugh at.